and someone who would also hand in the past provided adequate intelligence, and then they were to replay that interrogation for the visiting VIPs. And essentially, as an intelligence professional, this was insulting. And I don't think I was alone in feeling this way, to be honest with you, because in the intelligence community, your whole existence is in order to provide policymakers with the right information to make the right decisions. So that's really the existence of the intelligence community, to simply provide the right information. And this concept of creating this fictitious world so Gitmo would look like one thing to those visiting, when in reality it was something far different, completely undermined everything that we, as professionals, were trying to do in intelligence. It was possible for supervisors to watch any interrogation through a one-way mirror in each room, but they rarely did so, according to SAR. Important sessions with high-value detainees were supposed to be recorded on concealed video cameras. If they had been, senior officers might have been as distressed as this translator was by such sexually perverse tactics and put a stop to them. "Not so," says SAR. There were also cameras in the booths, but the sessions were not recorded. General Jeffrey Miller thought taping could only cause legal problems. The video was simply fed to a screen in the observation room. For the overwhelming majority of sessions, the only ones who ever knew what took place in the booth were the interrogator, the linguist, and the detainee. Outsourcing torture. Additional evidence of the spread of stealth torture as a means of forcing intelligence from resistant suspects is revealed in secret CIA programs that whisked prisoners to foreign countries that had agreed to do the dirty job for the United States. In a policy known as renditions, or extraordinary renditions, dozens, perhaps hundreds of high-value terrorists, HVTs, were taken to a number of foreign countries, often in business jets leased by the CIA. President Bush apparently authorized the CIA to have detainees in custody disappeared or rendered to countries where the use of torture is well known and documented by Amnesty International. Such prisoners were kept incommunicado in long-term secret detention facilities in undisclosed locations. In reverse renditions, foreign authorities arrested suspects in non-combat, non-battlefield settings and transferred them into custody, usually to Guantanamo Bay Prison, without the basic legal protections afforded by international law. The president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, said of this program, "I call it outsourcing torture. What it really means is that in the so-called war on terror, the CIA picks up people anywhere in the world that it wants, and if it doesn't want to engage in the torture itself, or in the interrogation, whatever term you want to use, it will send them to another country that our intelligence agencies have a close relationship with. That can be Egypt, it can be Jordan." One CIA senior officer in charge of this rendition program was Michael Schur. He reports matter-of-factly, "We took people to the countries of their origin in the Middle East, if those countries had a legal process outstanding for them and were willing to take them. That person would be treated according to the laws of that country, not to the laws of the United States, but to the laws of, take your pick, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan." Obviously, the interrogation tactics used in those countries would include torture techniques that the CIA did not want to know about, as long as there was any useful intel coming out of them. However, it is difficult in our high-tech era to keep such a program concealed for long. Some of America's allies have led a probe into at least 30 flights suspected of being engaged by the CIA in the outsourcing torture program. The investigation has revealed that key suspects were transported to Soviet-era compounds in Eastern Europe. In my judgment, these programs of outsourcing torture indicate not that the CIA and military intelligence operatives were reluctant to torture prisoners, but that they believed that agents in those countries knew how to do it better. They have been perfecting the practice of the third degree longer than the Americans have. I have outlined here only a small sample of the far more extensive abuses heaped upon all sorts of detainees in American military prisons, in order to refute the administration's assertion that such abuse and torture were not systematic. Autopsies and death reports on detainees held in facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan reveal that nearly half of the 44 deaths reported occurred during or after interrogations by Navy SEALs, military intelligence, or the CIA. These homicides resulted from abusive interrogation tactics that included hooding, gagging, strangulation, beating with blunt objects, waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and extreme temperature manipulations. The executive director of the ACLU, Anthony Romero, has made it clear that there is no question that interrogations have resulted in deaths. High-ranking officials who knew about the torture sat on their hands, and those who created and endorsed these policies must be held accountable. Taking it to the top, holding Dick Cheney and George W. Bush accountable. As became increasingly obvious in the months after the Abu Ghraib photos came to public light, this pattern of abuse did not result from the acts of individual soldiers who broke the rules. It resulted from decisions made by the Bush administration to bend, ignore, or cast rules aside. Administration policies created the climate for Abu Ghraib and for abuse against detainees worldwide in a number of ways. This summary statement by Human Rights Watch in its report, United States, Getting Away with Torture, focuses our attention at the very top of the long chain of command, all the way up to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. The War on Terror framed the torture paradigm shift. In line with previous presidential failures in their War on Nouns, on poverty and drugs, the Bush administration declared a war on terror following the attacks of September 11, 2001. The central premise of this new war was that terrorism is the primary threat to national security and to the homeland, and that it must be opposed by all means necessary. This ideological foundation has been used by virtually all nations as a device for gaining popular and military support for aggression, as well as repression. It was used freely by right-wing dictatorships in Brazil, Greece, and many other nations in the 1960s and 70s to justify torture and death squad executions of their citizens who were positioned as the enemies of the state. Italy's right-wing Christian Democrats used the strategy of tension during the late 1970s to exaggerate the fear of terrorism by the Red Brigades, radical communists, as a means of political control. Of course, the classic example is that of Hitler's labeling Jews the originators of Germany's economic collapse of the 1930s. They were the internal threat that justified an external program of conquest and demanded their extermination both in Germany and in all the countries the Nazis occupied. Fear is the state's psychological weapon of choice to frighten citizens into sacrificing their basic freedoms and rule of law protections in exchange for the security promised by their all-powerful government. Fear was the linchpin that gained the majority support of the U.S. public and Congress first for a preemptive war against Iraq, and later for the mindless maintenance of a variety of Bush administration policies. First, fear was spread in Orwellian fashion by predicting a nuclear attack against the United States and its allies by Saddam Hussein's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. For example, on the eve of the congressional vote on the Iraq War Resolution, President Bush told the nation and Congress that Iraq was an evil nation that threatened America's security. Knowing these realities, Bush remarked, Americans must not ignore the threat gathering against us. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud. That mushroom cloud was spread over America not by Saddam, but by Bush's team. Over the next several years, all key members of the Bush administration echoed such dire warnings in speech after speech. A report was prepared by the Special Investigations Division of the Committee on Government Reform for Representative Henry A. Waxman on the Bush administration's public statements on Iraq. It used a public database of all such statements by Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. According to the report, these five officials made 237 specific false and misleading statements on the Iraqi threat in 125 public appearances, an average of about 50 for each disciple. In the month of September 2002, the first anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration is on record as having made nearly 50 misleading and deceptive statements to the public. In his investigative analysis, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Suskind traces much of the Bush administration's framing of the war on terror to Cheney's statement right after 9/11. Cheney defined it, "If there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. It's not about our analysis, it's about our response." Suskind writes in his book, The 1% Doctrine, "So, now spoken, it stood, a standard of action that would frame events and responses from the administration for years to come." He goes on to note that, unfortunately, the vast federal government does not operate efficiently or effectively under new forms of stress, like this war on terror, and under cognitive dissonance from the unexpected insurgency and rebellion of captive peoples. It has protective urges, competing agendas, rules for who does what and who represents actions to the citizenry, the sovereign, the bosses. It accomplishes a great deal, yes, but is defined often by its dysfunctions. And that means it lies and dissembles, hides what it can, and sometimes out of self-preservation, because without your trust of citizens, it is nothing but office space. A different method of fear-mongering can be seen in the politicization of the terror alarm, color code, warning system by the Bush administration's Department of Homeland Security. I believe that initially its intention was to serve, as all disaster warnings do, to mobilize citizens to prepare for a threat. However, over time, the 11 vague warnings never carried any realistic advice for citizen action. Warned of a hurricane, people are told to evacuate. Warned of a tornado, we know that we must retreat to the storm cellar. But warned of a terrorism attack coming sometime, somewhere, we are told simply to be more watchful, and of course to go about our business as usual. There was never any public explanation or debriefing when each of these many threats failed to materialize, despite their alleged credible sources. Mobilizing national forces for each rise in threat level costs at least $1 billion a month and creates unnecessary anxiety and stress in the population. In the end, broadcasting the color-coded threat levels was less a valid warning system than the government's costly way of ensuring and sustaining the nation's fear of terrorists in the absence of any terror attacks. French existentialist author Albert Camus has pointed out that fear is a method. Terror makes fear, and fear stops people from thinking rationally. It makes people think in abstractions about the enemy, the terrorists, the insurgents who threaten us, who thus must be destroyed. Once we begin thinking of people as a class of entities, as abstractions, then they meld into faces of the enemy, and primitive impulses to kill and torture them surface even among ordinarily peaceful people. I am on record with my criticism of these phantom alarms as dysfunctional and dangerous, but there is evidence that increases in Bush's poll ratings were closely correlated with the sounding of these warnings. The issue here is that by arousing and sustaining fear of an enemy at our gates, the Bush administration was able to position the president as the almighty commander-in-chief of a nation at war. By calling himself commander-in-chief and vastly expanding the powers granted him by Congress, President Bush and his advisers came to believe that they were above national and international law, and that therefore any of their policies were legal, simply by asserting them in a newly recast official legal interpretation. The seeds for the flowers of evil that blossomed in that dark dungeon of Abu Ghraib were planted by the Bush administration in its triangular framing of national security threats, citizen fear and vulnerability, and interrogation torture to win the war on terror. Vice President Dick Cheney as the Vice President of Torture. A Washington Post editorial called Dick Cheney the Vice President of Torture because of his efforts to defeat and finally to modify the McCain Amendment to the Department of Defense's budget authorization bill. That amendment demanded the humane treatment of prisoners in American military custody. Cheney had lobbied hard to get an exception to the law granted for the CIA in order to enable it to use whatever means it deemed necessary to extract information from its suspects. Cheney argued that such a bill would tie the hands of CIA operatives and expose them to potential prosecution for their efforts in the global war on terror. And we've gotten a glimpse of how extremely brutal and lethal their efforts can be. The legislation proposed by Senator John McCain, a former prisoner of war in Vietnam who himself experienced the horrors of torture, bans the use of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment by any government agency. It also requires all military interrogations to conform to the Army's Field Manual on Intelligence Interrogation, FM 34-52. Not only was the bill passed 90-9 in the Senate, it was endorsed strongly in a personal letter to McCain by more than a dozen top military commanders from the Marines, Army, and Navy. They asserted that the Army Field Manual is the tried and true gold standard that should be followed consistently. As a postscript, these generals and admirals believe that when agencies other than DOD, Department of Defense, detain and interrogate prisoners, there should be no legal loopholes permitting cruel and degrading treatment. McCain takes a broad perspective on torture and the need to right America's moral compass. In a Newsweek magazine essay on The Truth About Torture, McCain held that this is a war of ideas, a struggle to advance freedom in the face of terror in places where oppressive rule had bred the malevolence that creates terrorists. Prisoner abuses extract a terrible toll on us in this war of ideas. They inevitably become public, and when they do, they threaten our moral standing. The mistreatment of prisoners harms us more than our enemies. It is unlikely that passage of this legislation will dim Cheney's passionate support for the CIA's use of all the means at its disposal to get confessions and intelligence from secretly held terror suspects. This must be so when we consider Cheney's steadfast adherence to the beliefs he expressed shortly after the 9/11 attacks. In a televised interview on NBC's Meet the Press, Cheney made a remarkable statement. "We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful. That's the world these folks operate in, and so it's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically, to achieve our objective." In an NPR interview, the former Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, charged that the Cheney-Bush team of neoconservatives issued directives that led to the prisoner abuses by soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Wilkerson outlined the path such directives took. "It was clear to me that there was a visible audit trail from the Vice President's, Cheney's, office through the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, down to the commanders in the field that, in carefully couched terms, that to a soldier in the field meant two things. We're not getting enough good intelligence, and you need to get that evidence. And, oh, by the way, here's some ways you can probably get it." Wilkerson also referred to David Addington, Cheney's counsel, as a staunch advocate of allowing the president in his capacity as commander-in-chief to deviate from the Geneva Conventions. This leads us right up to the pinnacle of power. President George W. Bush as the Commander-in-Chief of War. As commander in charge of an open-ended war on global terrorism, President George W. Bush has relied on a team of legal advisors to establish a legitimate basis for a preemptive war of aggression against Iraq, to redefine torture, to create new rules of engagement, to restrict citizens' freedoms through the so-called Patriot Act, and to authorize illegal eavesdropping, wiretapping, and spying on the phone calls of American citizens. As usual, all this is done in the name of protecting the sacred homeland national security in the global war against you-know-what. Bush's legal advisory team consisted of Alberto R. Gonzalez, counsel to the president, subsequently promoted to attorney general, John Yoo, deputy assistant attorney general, and J.S. Bybee, assistant attorney general, both of the Department of Justice. Attorney General John Ashcroft, and William H. Taft IV, Legal Advisor, State Department. Alberto Gonzalez offered the following legal judgment to the President. Memo, January 25, 2002. The nature of the new war places a high premium on other factors, such as the ability to quickly obtain information. In my judgment, this new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners. The Torture Memos. An August 1, 2002 Department of Justice memo, referred to in the press as the Torture Memo, narrowly defined torture in terms not of what it constitutes, but only in terms of its most extreme consequences. It held that physical pain must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. In line with this memo, in order to prosecute anyone charged with torture crimes, it is necessary that it must have been the specific intent of the defendant to cause severe physical or mental pain or suffering. Mental torture was narrowly defined to include only acts that would result in significant psychological harm of significant duration, e.g., lasting for months or years. The memo went on to assert that the earlier ratification of the 1994 anti-torture statute could be considered unconstitutional because it would interfere with the president's power as commander-in-chief. Other guidelines from the Justice Department's lawyers gave the president the power to reinterpret the Geneva Conventions to suit the administration's purposes in the war on terror. Belligerents captured in Afghanistan, Taliban soldiers, Al-Qaeda suspects, insurgents, and all those rounded up and taken into custody would not be considered POWs, and therefore not granted any of the legal protections to which a prisoner of war is entitled. As enemy combatants, they could be held indefinitely at any facility in the world, without counsel or specific charges leveled against them. In addition, the president apparently approved the CIA's program of disappearing high-value terrorists. The evidence is circumstantial, but it is convincing. For example, in his book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, James Risen concludes that there is a secret agreement among very senior administration officials to insulate Bush and to give him deniability in regard to the CIA's involvement in the extreme new interrogation tactics. A less gracious description of the relationship between President Bush and his team of legal advisors came from the legal scholar Anthony Lewis after he had thoroughly reviewed all the available memoranda. The memos read like the advice of a mob lawyer to a mafia don on how to skirt the law and stay out of prison. Avoiding prosecution is literally a theme of the memoranda. Another theme in the memoranda, an even more deeply disturbing one, is that the president can order the torture of prisoners even though it is forbidden by a federal statute and by the International Convention Against Torture, to which the United States is a party. Readers are invited to read all the relevant materials I have outlined here, the investigative reports, ICRC report, and more, along with all 28 torture memos by President Bush's legal advisors, Rumsfeld, Powell, Bush, and others that prepared the way for the legitimization of torture in Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and Iraq. In a remarkable 1,249-page volume, The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib, edited by Karen Greenberg and Joshua Dreitel, the full paper trail of memoranda is laid out, exposing the perversion of legal skills by government lawyers. It provides us with an insight into how such skills that have done so much to protect Americans in this most legalized of countries can be misused in the cause of evil. The editors conclude in no uncertain terms what the significance of these documents should be for citizens to understand the motives and intentions of their elected leaders and of other government officials. While the proverbial road to hell is paved with good intentions, the internal government memos collected in this publication demonstrate that the path to the purgatory that is Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib has been paved with decidedly bad intentions. The policies that resulted in rampant abuse of detainees first in Afghanistan, then at Guantanamo Bay, and later in Iraq, were the product of three pernicious purposes designed to facilitate the unilateral and unfettered detention, interrogation, abuse, judgment, and punishment of prisoners. One, the desire to place the detainees beyond the reach of any court or law. Two, the desire to abrogate the Geneva Convention with respect to the treatment of persons seized in the context of armed hostilities. And three, the desire to absolve those implementing the policies of any liability for war crimes under U.S. and international law. Indeed, any claim of good faith that those who formulated the policies were merely misguided in their pursuit of security in the face of what is certainly a genuine terrorist threat is belied by the policymakers' more than tacit acknowledgement of their unlawful purpose. The message that these memoranda convey in response is unmistakable. These policymakers do not like our system of justice, with its checks and balances and rights and limits that they have been sworn to uphold. That antipathy for and distrust of our civilian and military justice systems is positively un-American. Law professor Jordan Paust, former captain, U.S. Army Judge Advocate General's Corps, wrote of George W. Bush's legal advisors, who prepared these justifications for torture against detainees, "Not since the Nazi era have so many lawyers been so clearly involved in international crimes concerning the treatment and interrogation of persons detained during war." Heading the list of advisors is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who helped develop a legal memo that reinterpreted torture as noted above. Not until the Abu Ghraib photos were disclosed did Gonzalez and President Bush repudiate this memo, offering the most extreme conception of torture. Gonzalez's dedication to expanding presidential powers within the framework of the War on Terror has been compared to that of the influential Nazi lawyer Carl Schmitt. Schmitt's ideas about freeing the nation's executive from legal constraints in times of emergency helped suspend Germany's constitution and gave Hitler total power. Gonzalez's biographer noted that Gonzalez is a likable man who comes across as an ordinary man without sadistic or psychopathic tendencies. However, in his institutional role, Gonzalez's legal memos have been responsible for suspension of civil liberties and brutal interrogation of terrorist suspects in violation of international law. Gitmo interrogations opposed by the Defense Department's Criminal Investigation Task Force. According to a recent MSNBC report, leaders of the Defense Department's Criminal Investigation Task Force said that they had repeatedly warned senior Pentagon officials, beginning in early 2002 and continuing for years after, that the harsh interrogation techniques used by a separate intelligence team would not produce reliable information, could constitute war crimes, and would embarrass the nation when they became public knowledge. The concerns and advice of these experienced criminal investigators were largely ignored by all those in the chain of command directing the interrogations at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib in favor of their preferred intense coercive forms of interrogation. Alberto J. Mora, the former general counsel of the Navy, has gone on record supporting the members of this task force. What makes me intensely proud of all these individuals was that they said, "We will not be party to this, even if we are ordered to do so." They are heroes, and there's no other way to describe them. They demonstrated enormous personal courage and personal integrity in standing up for American values and the system we all live for. In the end, these investigators were not able to stop the abuses, but only to slow them down by getting Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to roll back some of his harshest interrogation tactics. Obsession with the War on Terror. We can see that Bush's obsession with the War on Terror has propelled him further down the dangerous path laid out in the late Senator Barry Goldwater's dictum, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." Accordingly, President Bush has authorized domestic surveillance of American citizens by the National Security Agency, NSA, without legally mandated warrants. In what amounts to a large data mining operation, a huge volume of telephone and internet traffic has been gathered by the NSA and sent to the FBI for analysis, actually overwhelming its capacities for effective processing of such information. Such surveillance requires backdoor access to the major telecommunications switches on American soil that route international calls, and the secret cooperation of the nation's largest telecommunications companies, according to a detailed New York Times report of January 2006. The Times exposé has revealed the excess inherent in vesting such power in the president without the restraints of legal or congressional checks and balances. A case has been made for comparing Bush's sense of being above the law with that of President Richard Nixon, who unleashed the dogs of domestic surveillance in the 1970s and defended doing so by his assertion, "When the president does it, that means it is not illegal." Bush now says the very same thing with the same sense of impunity. This sense of being above the law is seen also in Bush's unprecedented use of signing statements. In the process of approving a law passed by Congress, the president affirms his prerogative not to follow the law he has just signed. President Bush has used this tactic more than any other president has in U.S. history, more than 750 times, to disobey statutes passed by Congress when they conflict with his interpretation of the Constitution. This included placing this personal restraint on the McCain Amendment against torture. However, President Bush's assertion of executive power has been challenged in a recent decision of the Supreme Court that limits his authority. It repudiated the Bush administration's plans to put Guantanamo detainees on trial before military commissions, tribunals, because they were unauthorized by federal statute and they violated international law. According to the New York Times, the ruling marked the most significant setback yet for the administration's broad expansion of presidential power. Paradoxically, in its desire to rid the world of the evil of terrorism, the Bush administration has itself become a glaring exemplar of administrative evil. It is an organization that inflicts pain and suffering unto death, while willingly using formal, rational, and efficient procedures to disguise the substance of what it does, ignoring the means to justify what its members consider to be higher-order ends. Other examples of this mechanism of administrative evil at work include the Nazis' extermination of Jews in the Holocaust, NASA's role in the Challenger disaster, the promotion of addictive cigarettes by American tobacco company executives and their hired scientific experts, and the deceptive business practices of Enron and other crooked companies. Administrative evil is systemic, in the sense that it exists beyond any one person once its policies are in place and its procedures take control. Nevertheless, I would argue, organizations must have leaders, and those leaders must be held accountable for creating or maintaining such evil. I believe that a system consists of those agents and agencies whose power and values create or modify the rules of and expectations for approved behavior within its sphere of influence. In one sense, the system is more than the sum of its parts and of its leaders, who also fall under its powerful influences. In another sense, however, the individuals who play key roles in creating a system that engages in illegal, immoral, and unethical conduct should be held accountable, despite the situational pressures on them. President Bush and his advisors have been able to alter the War Crimes Act of 1996 by pushing Congress to pass the United States Military Commissions Act of 2006, Senate Bill 3930, that he signed on October 17, 2006. It was drafted in part to rebuff the Supreme Court's decision on Hamdan v. Rumsfeld that has challenged the administration's use of military tribunals in trials of detainees at Guantanamo Prison. This new Military Commissions Act provides for a host of controversial practices relating to the U.S. government's detention and treatment of unlawful enemy combatants. All those so designated are afforded neither the military rights of soldiers nor those of civilians in civil law. The president is given broad wartime powers to designate anyone as fitting that category, including American citizens, thereby losing their right of habeas corpus and protections provided by the Geneva Conventions. They may be imprisoned indefinitely, tried only by a military tribunal, whose judge may use hearsay evidence even when obtained without a search warrant, and whose finding of guilt requires only a two-thirds majority of tribunal members. In addition, it harbors at least two more objectionable features, permitting many interrogation tactics that qualify as only humiliating, and retroactively protecting all government officials who may have been involved in crimes against humanity, including the murder of interrogated detainees by CIA operatives and others. Thus, virtually all the abuses by the MPs at Abu Ghraib are now allowable, because they would qualify as merely humiliating, not as torture. Upholding the War Crimes Act and the Geneva Conventions should be indispensable for all civilized nations that choose to live by the rule of law and not by the rule of power and tyranny. The Military Commissions Act is a tyrannical law that will be ranked with the low points in American democracy, our generation's version of the Alien and Sedition Acts, according to a New York Times editorial, September 28, 2006. Where is the outrage by citizens and freedom-loving people everywhere? Members of the jury, your verdict, please. You have read here the testimony of many eyewitnesses, as well as key sections of the summary reports by the major independent investigative panels, along with parts of the extensive analyses by Human Rights Watch, the Red Cross, the ACLU, Amnesty International, and PBS's Frontline about the nature of the abuse and torture of prisoners in the custody of the U.S. military. Do you now believe that the mistreatment of detainees in Abu Ghraib's Tier 1A by Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick and the other MPs on night shift duty was an aberration, an isolated incident caused solely by a few bad apples, allegedly rogue soldiers? Further, do you now believe that such abuse and torture was or was not part of a systematic program of coercive interrogation? Did the extent of the abuses and torture in these interrogations go far deeper and well beyond the limited time, place, and set of actors in the Abu Ghraib Tier 1A night shift? Given the acknowledged guilt of those MPs charged with the photographed abuses, do you now believe that there were sufficient situational forces, a bad barrel, and system pressures, bad barrel makers, acting on them that should have mitigated the extent of their prison sentences? Are you willing and ready to make a judgment of complicity in the abuses at Abu Ghraib and many other military facilities and secretly run CIA jails of each of the following high-ranking members of the military command? Major General Jeffrey Miller, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, Colonel Thomas Pappas, and Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan. Are you willing and ready to make a judgment of complicity in the abuses at Abu Ghraib and many other military facilities and secretly run CIA jails of each of the following top members of the political command? Former CIA Director George Tenet and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Are you willing and ready to make a judgment of complicity in the abuses at Abu Ghraib and many other military facilities and secretly run CIA jails of each of the following top members of the political command? Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. The prosecution rests. However, you might also want to look at a note about a recent tribunal that tried the Bush administration for its crimes against humanity. While you are deliberating, consider this final section about a positive attempt by the military system to acknowledge the necessity of proper guard training and effective institutional constraints on abuses of power in interrogating prisoners. Had such procedures been in place from the start, it is likely that the abuses at Abu Ghraib would not have happened. The SPE goes to Abu Ghraib as a training guide against power overload and humanity outages. On the long flight from Hawaii to Baghdad, Army Colonel Larry James watched the DVD of the Stanford Prison Experiment, Quiet Rage, over and over, maybe as many as 24 times. What did Zimbardo do wrong? What should he have done differently to prevent the abuses in his prison? He raised these questions because he was en route to a special mission. Fix Abu Ghraib. Dr. James is a distinguished clinical psychologist who for years was chair of the Department of Psychology, Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He was given this unique task in May 2004, at the command of Major General Jeffrey Miller, with whom he had worked in the Guantanamo Bay prison. Yes, the very same general whose earlier strategies and tactics had done so much damage in the prisons in both Cuba and Iraq. As Chief Behavioral Science Director, James reported directly to Major General Miller. As one of the highest-ranking officers in the prison, James was able to get his policies and procedures enacted almost immediately. I had given James several sets of our newly made DVD when I learned he was headed to Abu Ghraib. He had suggested that I join him on the mission, but I was too fearful of the danger to go with him. I would have gladly joined him had it not been for the lethal environment that existed in that prison and throughout Iraq. I interviewed James upon his return, asking him what he had decided would be the best set of prevention strategies to safeguard against new abuses. In general, his goal was to set up procedures that would create and maintain good order and discipline in this prison setting and would meet the criteria of the American Correctional Association. He arranged for site visits at Abu Ghraib Prison and also at Camp Buka by an Army Lieutenant Colonel who was the chief of the Behavioral Science Department, Disciplinary Barracks, Leavenworth, Kansas, and also by a site reviewer for the American Correctional Association. All of their findings and recommendations were implemented. Because of their survey of conditions, a mental health hospital was built for the prisoners, and a large team of mental health professionals was detailed to Abu Ghraib to provide services to detainees, for the first time. Next, he established some basic ground rules for himself. 1. Do no harm. 2. Keep everything safe, physically and psychologically. Healthcare should mirror the standards adopted by the American Correctional Association. 3. Keep everything legal. Meet all principles of the Uniformed Code of Military Justice. 4. Keep everything ethical. Be sure no one is ever harmed and continually ask, did I do anything to violate the ethical standards of the American Psychological Association? 5. Make interrogations effective. Create conditions that transform interrogations into detective-like interviews of inmates that are designed to acquire the intelligence necessary to save American lives in non-abusive ways. Colonel James walked the grounds at night and at random times, talking with guards and staff, always being cognizant of abuses, wrongdoing, or conduct inconsistent with good order and discipline. He worked personally to stop problems or misconduct, or, if he could not resolve any issue, reported his concerns directly to the general. After examining every aspect of the prison, Colonel James established the following 7 layers of prison oversight and rules governing the treatment and interrogation of prisoners at Abu Ghraib Prison, presumably to be extended to other facilities. 1. There must be supervision by senior officers at all times, including night shifts. 2. Interrogations must be replaced by interviews following the model of a U.S. detective investigation at a police headquarters. One person alone must never conduct the interviews. There must be at least 2 present in the interview booth, the interviewer and translator at a minimum. This way they can check on each other and have dual feedback available. 3. A written no-go policy must make explicit what actions are prohibited and what are permitted during these prisoner interviews, eliminating any ambiguity about what can and cannot be done or justified. 4. Mandatory mission-specific training must be required of all those involved in these interviews. 5. Interview booths must be open to surveillance through one-way observation mirrors, enabling viewing from hall corridors by officers and others. And all interviews must be videotaped for subsequent analysis and administrative review. 6. Military police will regularly rove the entire facility at random intervals, reporting regularly to higher-ups and making guards and interviewers aware that they are always under surveillance. James also arranged for 2 military psychologists to be his roving ambassadors in this way. 7. Multiple layers of supervision and oversight are required, with medical inspection of each prisoner interviewed pre- and again post-interview to report any signs of changed medical status as a consequence of the interview procedure. Similarly, a military attorney must review all procedures, along with other layers of regular supervision built into the system. Although it was not part of these official procedures, Larry James encouraged the MPs to watch Quiet Rage, the Stanford Prison Experiment, and discuss its message about abuse of power as it might relate to their new role of being a guard within that prison setting. Would he have been able to install such strong oversight procedures before the revelation of the abuses? It's hard to say, but I think it is unlikely that anyone would have even thought to create this mission. Had this set of procedures been in place, is it less likely the abuses would have occurred? That seems certainly to be so, because such conditions would have eliminated the confusion and the diffusion of responsibility, while also making it apparent that everyone's behavior was under surveillance. Of course, that also extends to what should have been happening at the SPE. It's good that many seemingly effective practices are in place, but have they made a difference? James's answer was, "My dependent variable is there have been no abuses since these rules have been put in place, as of November 2005. Since then, the Pentagon has decided to shut down the prison at Abu Ghraib, releasing some of its detainees and transferring others to Camp Cropper near the Baghdad airport. Britain's top legal advisor has recently called for the United States to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, which over the years has held a total of 759 prisoners, according to the Department of Defense. He believes that this detention center has become an international symbol of injustice. Attorney General Peter Goldsmith said that the reliance of that camp on military tribunals does not meet the British commitment to the principle of a fair trial in accordance with international standards. Spain's most prominent investigative magistrate, Baltasar Garzon, also called on the United States to shut down this prison as an insult to countries that respect laws. He says Spain learned the lesson from the evils of the Inquisition that torture and degradation do not work as investigative techniques. Colonel Larry James was awarded the Bronze Star for this special military service. It is a great pleasure for me to be able to end this chapter, celebrating this singular accomplishment of my colleague and friend. I wish that he had been empowered to do so a few years earlier. Let the sunshine in. Well, we've made it to the end of our long journey together. I appreciate your staying power to continue on, despite these confrontations with some of what is worse in human nature. It has been especially difficult for me to revisit the scenes of abuse in the Stanford prison experiment. It has also been tough to face up to my ineffectiveness in helping achieve a better resolution in the case of Chip Frederick. As a perennial optimist facing all the evils of genocide, massacres, lynchings, torture, and other horrible things that people do to other people is starting to dim my positive outlook on the human condition. In the final phase of our journey, we will let the sunshine in to illuminate these dark corners of the human psyche. It is time to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. I shall do so in two ways. First, you will get some well-reasoned advice on how to resist the social influences that you don't want and don't need, but that bombard you and most of us daily. While acknowledging the power of situational forces to influence most of us to behave badly in many contexts, I also make it evident that we are not slaves to their power. It is through understanding how such forces operate that we can resist, oppose, and prevent them from leading us into undesirable temptation. Such knowledge can liberate us from subjugation to the mighty grasp of conformity, compliance, persuasion, and other forms of social influence and coercion. Having explored the weaknesses, frailties, and all-too-easy transformations of human character throughout our journey, we end on a most positive note by celebrating heroism and heroes. By now, I hope you are willing to accept the premise that ordinary people, even good ones, can be seduced, recruited, initiated into behaving in evil ways under the sway of powerful systematic and situational forces. If so, are you also ready to endorse the reverse premise, that any of us is a potential hero waiting for a situation to arise that will enable us to show that we have the right stuff? Let's now learn how to resist temptation and celebrate heroes.